Welcome back, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. You're tuned into the Asia-Pacific Perspective, where we take a look at the Asia-Pacific region with our good friend and co-host Brock West of the Asia-Pacific Perspective blog, APPerspective.net. Brock, it is great to talk to you once again. Thank you for joining us.
James, as you know, always a pleasure, mate. Thanks for having me on again for our final episode of 2014. Can you believe it? Time surely flies this year.
It sure does. I can hardly believe it myself, but it seems like just yesterday that you and I were talking about the G20 there in Australia, and this month as well, a lot of interesting breaking news in Australia, as I'm sure the listeners are already somewhat aware, but let's fill in some of those details. What's happening there in Sydney?
Yeah, well, obviously, I'm quite a way north from Sydney, and obviously the biggest story here at the moment is, of course, the hostage situation that unfolded in Sydney on Monday. As you can imagine, the corporate media here has gone into a hysteric frenzy with all the usual fear porn headlines that go part and parcel with these types of events, sadly. For those viewers wanting a play-by-play of the event, I'm sure they can source that under their own volition. However, I'd just like to speak to a few interesting points that have piqued my interest in the last 48 hours since the siege at Martin Place. Firstly, the gunman, a 50-year-old man named Manharan Monis, a self-proclaimed cleric, received political asylum in Australia in 2001 after being incredibly critical of the Iranian regime. Also in 2001, during an ABC interview, he claimed to be part of the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence and Security. Moving forward to 2005, then Prime Minister John Howard publicly backed the idea of government infiltrating Islamic mosques and schools within Australia to monitor terrorist activities. In another interview later, Monis claimed he was framed by the Iranian Secret Service and Australia's Domestic Intelligence Agency. Monis was already well known to Australian authorities and media for his erratic and extremely dangerous behaviour, including numerous sexual assault charges and being an accessory to the murder of his then ex-wife, but strangely was released on bail for both counts for incredibly weak prosecution arguments. He was a publicly vocal critic and protester of Australia's role in the War of Terror, writing numerous upsetting protest letters to the families of deceased soldiers who were killed in the Afghanistan War. And finally, in 2013, very interestingly here, James, 1 year prior, a terror drill was conducted at Martin Place by the Australian Defence Forces, which, of course, is the location that the siege took place. So, James, it's really, in my opinion, too early to come to any genuine conclusions as to, as we always encourage you out there to do your own research and analysis. But given the bizarre and dangerous background of this man, not to mention the recent raising of the terror level here in Australia by the government, and also the well-documented history of intelligence agencies aiding and coercing dangerous and unstable individuals, it at the very least raises a couple of red flags for me. What are your initial thoughts on this, James?
My initial thoughts go towards what our good friend James Evan Pilato of Media Monarchy always says in these situations: the real action is in the reaction. And I'm not there in Australia, so I don't have a good handle on the reaction. But my impression is that they're now trying to put this into a lone wolf narrative and trying to disconnect it from the ISIS links that have been there. Is that what's going on right now?
Exactly right. During the early stages of the siege, a generic Islamic flag was held up by one of the hostages in the window, and that was incredibly quickly jumped onto as an Islamic State act of terrorism. And even at the 2 p.m. edition of the Daily Telegraph, which of course is, like most of our media here in Australia, owned by Rupert Murdoch, was basically pinning this on an ISIS death cult, and it was really, really horrific to see that kind of fear propaganda being spun up so quickly. But that has quickly been shut off, and yet basically they're going down the lone wolf, crazy, deranged gunman narrative that we have seen time and time again.
Yeah, Yeah, well, this seems to me, then that seems to fit the bill of basically this is a crazy guy that they knew about. They were letting him run around to be crazy, and this is going to backfire on them. So they're now trying to distance him and sort of sweep the details of this under the rug as quickly as possible. That's my impression of this situation. And it is, it's interesting because to think that just a few months ago, this would have been the fear porn manna from heaven for the Australian authorities that were trying to pump this narrative of, you know, every Australian is a secret ISIS, you know, wannabe or whatever. That was the main theme just a few months ago, and now they're trying to downplay the links here. So clearly this is not propagandistically useful for them at this particular juncture, so they're trying to kind of use this obviously to pump through the kind of general terror legislation, but they don't want to look too much at the actual links of this person. And so it's an interesting kind of bipolar response going on here. And I think that's really the interesting part of this. Again, I don't think that this seems to be connected into any larger plot. I think it is just a crazy person who was known about by authorities, as you say, was interviewed, was running around calling himself an Iranian Shia cleric and everything, despite the fact that he clearly wasn't, and all of this nonsense for years and years. Members of the Muslim community were trying to point him out to Australian authorities. They ignored him. So again, this is all just going to blow back in their face if they look at it too carefully, which is why we're probably going to see this incident, or at least the details of this incident, memory hold pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think at the very least you'd have to say this is a total failure by the Australian judicial system to deal with this dangerous and obviously deranged individual, but I guess only time will tell if there were more nefarious forces at play behind this tragic event. So in the meantime, James, viewers can always check into the show notes for some more interesting articles that we will have posted for them. So with that said, James, let's move quickly on to our second segment. And for those who were with us on the last episode of Asia Pacific Perspective, you'll know that we dedicated the entire episode to the G20 in Brisbane that took place this past November, which I am happy to say, to report, actually came and went with very few arrests and none of the terrible scenes that we saw in years gone by. James, during our discussion last month, you mentioned the importance of paying attention to what is actually happening inside these globalist summits, and more importantly, what comes out of them once the collective dust has settled, so to speak. I did that, you know, in the days and weeks after the event, and basically all I came up with was the usual empty political rhetoric, you know, of more jobs, economic growth, and tackling climate change, blah, blah, blah. But I understand you've got an interesting article from Ellen Brown that you think is worth looking into.
That's right. Ellen Brown has been really doing the yeoman's work here, dredging up some details about a plan that was basically rubber stamped at the G20 that was drawn up by the Financial Stability Board, which is an offshoot of the BIS that was launched by the G8 or the whatever it was back in the day before the G20 even came on the scene. And this is a really important, really interesting organization that works basically behind the scenes. No one really knows anything about them except for the fact that they have been sort of put together to talk about how to restructure the global financial system in the wake of the Lehman Brothers collapse. And so they're working quietly behind the scenes on this. And one of the things that they've come up with is a bail-in plan, basically, that the G20 just rubber stamped, that's going to make it so that in the event of the next big banker bailout, it's going to be you bailing them in with your deposits, which are going to be considered as basically collateral against the banker's obligations. Surprise, surprise. What we saw in Cyprus is coming home to roost exactly as we predicted and as we talked about at the time when that Cyprus bail-in happened. That's going to be the template for the next round of banking crises. And this is, I mean, so important. I'm glad that Ellen Brown is looking at this, because I've been looking at the Financial Stability Board and the little white papers and things they've been working on for years now, but it's really interesting to see this now starting to come together at the G20 level and starting to be passed and codified into laws in various countries. So I am hoping to talk to Ellen Brown later this week. I certainly hope that interview is going to come together so we can talk about some more of the details. But having said that, yes, I'm glad that you did stress that that as we talked about last month, with these types of big G20 events and these circuses that they make them into, all of that tends to obscure and cloud the real things that are going on behind the scenes, and sometimes you have to dig pretty deeply to find out what was actually going on. And it could be the little thing that they rubber stamp in the corner in the background that you don't really pay attention to that may be the most important thing that comes out of these meetings. So once again, my hat's off to Ellen Brown for doing this work.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm definitely looking forward to that interview. James, use your crystal ball, if you will. What nation in the Asia Pacific would you say is most at risk of succumbing to this type of bail-in system that we've seen in Cyprus?
You know, honestly, I'm obviously biased living in Japan, but the Japanese banking sector is notoriously moribund. It has all of these zombie banks that were never killed in the 1990s slowdown, and thus have been sort of shuffling along for decade after decade, and now have these ridiculous debt levels. Their reserves are not up to snuff. I think there's a lot of skeletons in a lot of these banks' closets. If the Japanese banking sector starts to go, though, I mean, that's going to have global economic implications, so no one wants to see that happening. But there are a lot of zombie banks here that need to be killed one way or another, and who knows, that might be the first domino to fall in the global economic collapse.
I think so, and actually, James, that segues us very beautifully into our third and final segment today, which is, of course, well, for a lot of people, they may not even know, but there was a Japanese selection over the weekend, and you probably may have cared, but there was this election. There was a snap election that was called by Prime Minister Abe. And in a country where you need the finest and sharpest samurai sword or katana to split the difference between the main parties, Shinzo Abe and the LDP gained further control of the Diet, which is the Japanese parliament. So for a quick summary, we'll take this one from izakayapolitics.com with the headline reading, "Voter turnout was terrible, but Abe still claims a mandate with LDP victory." Voter turnout was the lowest in post-war history. It was so horrendous that Prime Minister Shinzo Abe even addressed it on TV, thanking voters who bothered to make it to the polls. Despite the low turnout, however, Abe's coalition is set to win a commanding number of seats, and Abe is already using the positive election result as validation for his policies. "I believe the results said that we have received a public mandate for the Abe administration's achievements over the past 2 years. The LDP will probably end up with 290 seats, down from a few from the previous election of 293. But considering all of the circumstances surrounding the snap election, this is a pretty solid outcome for Abe." Yuko Obuchi and Midori Matsushima, the former cabinet ministers who resigned over corruption allegations in October, both held onto their seats. If Japan is outraged by corruption in the Abe administration, then they aren't showing it. The opposition party DPJ were basically the ones responsible for ousting Obuchi and Matsushima, but their efforts didn't pay off in the long run. So, James, business as usual in Japanese politics, and the only positive I take out of this selection is the aforementioned record low voter turnout. I can only imagine what the numbers would be here in Australia if voting wasn't compulsory. I'll also post a link in the show notes to an article from the Japan Times citing that a novelty party in Hokkaido shows that 105,000 voters voted for none of the above. But that aside, I like yourself, James, am sure that I'm much more concerned with what the future holds for Japan's economic, nuclear and foreign policies, all of which I'll continue to shine a light on APPerspective.net. But what do you foresee in Japan coming into 2015, James?
Nothing good, and I want people to understand that all of this rhetoric from the Abe camp about this is a strong mandate for, you know, the next 4 years of his administration, complete BS. Do not buy it. There is no mandate here. As was pointed out, this is lowest turnout in Japanese post-war history, 52%, down 7 percentage points from the previous low, which was 2012, 59%. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that there was any sort of mandate here, and it's even more ridiculous in that 110 of the districts out of the 475 didn't even field a candidate by the main opposition party, the DPJ. Clearly, the snap election was called now and was done so quickly because this is the last best chance for Abe to sort of consolidate that power and win another 4 years, and it's only downhill from here. It's so ridiculous to think that there was any sort of popular surge of support for Abe given the absolute disaster of Abenomics, as was proven in spades this year. Japanese real wages declining for however many months in a row it is now, 26 or whatever it is, on top of the 7% contraction that we saw in the second and third quarters. I mean, the Japanese economy is getting worse and worse and worse, and they just keep putting more and more money in that hole because it's the only thing that they can do. It's the last the last arrow in their quiver. So it's just a self-transparent fraud. I think the voting public here is going to be more and more aware of that. We've already seen the shine coming off of Abe recently, which is, again, exactly why they called this election now, which is their last best chance to win before everything starts tanking next year. And it's not going to be pretty next year. I see absolutely no way out of it for Japan Inc., which has been obviously lumbering along for a couple of decades now, but it's been decades since they've managed to innovate anything, and that's really the only possible way forward for the Japanese economy, is to imagine that there's going to be some sort of innovative new thing from Sony or whatever. It's not going to happen. I think this is not going to end prettily, and Abe is probably not going to survive the next 4 years. Honestly, he's going to be voted out before then, but we'll see. We'll see what ultimately happens, and again, I just want people, don't believe the hype. This was not a popular mandate. People here just didn't vote because it was just absolutely a foregone conclusion that Abe was going to win this round, so it's just more of the same for next year.
Do you think, given the dire situation of Japan's economy, that the TPP is eventually going to be trumped out as this kind of white shining knight on his white steed?
This is going to be probably one of the main political issues domestically for the next couple of years, because right now Abe is kind of fighting against the various farmers associations, which have a huge deal of political clout here and are some of the main roadblocks to the TPP here in the country. So that's going to be a big fight that's going to shape up. And if they're able to frame it in such a way, oh, these outdated old farmers associations sticking up for farmers' rights, we got to get rid of that and pave the way for the new globalist manna from heaven that's going to come from TPP. If they can paint it that way, there may be an interesting shift taking place in Japanese politics, but I wouldn't count on it. I mean, Japan is very much cemented in its ways. It takes a long time for those types of changes to be implemented. So thankfully, there is a big roadblock to the TPP here in Japan through those types of farmers associations. We'll see how that fight shapes up, but I think that's going to be a key struggle for Abe in the next year or two.
Yeah, I totally agree, James. And just quickly, in some other updates from the land of the rising sun, Abe vows to rewrite constitution and instill patriotism into schools. Japan's controversial secrecy law comes into effect. And from your own FukushimaUpdate.com, British researcher blasts UN report on Fukushima cancer risk as unscientific. And finally, Fukushima makes a pitch to host some of the 2020 Olympic events. So some interesting things, James, as always. And yeah, as we said, this will be the last episode for 2014. So as our good friend James of Applied always says, it's humbling and an honour to do this with you month in, month out, James. So looking forward to APP in 2015, mate.
So am I. I'm not looking forward to the stories we're probably going to have to cover, but I am looking forward to doing it with you. Thank you again for all the work that you put into this.
Thank you, mate. We'll see you in the new year.